Shishiradha Krishna Gopa Govinda Shyamakunda Radha Kundagiri Govardhana Ki Shri Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Shri Mayapur Dhamma Ki Ganga Maya Ki Kundra Maya Ki Bhakti Deva Ki Tulasa Deva Ki Samaveta Bhakti Deva Ki Chayana Thai Road of Prima Nandi. All glories to the Sama Devotees. All glories to the Sama Devotees. All glories to the Sama Devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gaudanga. All glories to Shri Guru. Okay, so so this is Discourse 5 now, and this describes the Vanaprastha and the Sannyas Ashram.
5 or 6?
Huh?
Excuse me, 6,
you're right, 6. So then, first is then the law of the hermits, so that means the Vanaprastha. Hermits means Vanaprastha. And sannyas, yatis, renunciates, that means the sannyas ashram. Retiring to the forest. Taking a firm resolution and controlling his senses, may he dwell in the forest. So this is the first thing, is unless there's a resolution, there's a determination, then nothing works. So here is this is a firm resolution that has to be taken, because it's something serious. Anything you want to get done, the more serious it is, the stronger the resolution has to be. You know, that's the vyavasayatmika bud here, aka hakuru nandali. So when it's fixed, it's focused, then you get result. If it's not fixed, you don't get result. It'll be mixed. That's why the others, they don't really get a good result, because their mind's all over the place. They want to enjoy this, they want to enjoy that, they want to do so many things. So they're doing a little bit of everything, they're getting nowhere. You know, so you hear about those ones, like in the Bhagavatam, even they're doing karmakanda stuff, but they're focused on one thing. They only do one. They're not doing all this, that, so many different things. You know, so they do one thing, and then it works. So that's how the thing works. So if you want spiritual life, you have to be focused. So here, they're having to go from grihastha ashram, where the distraction will be in so many different things. You know, the focus is to make it work. But the details are very distracting. Many, many, many little things that are there. So here, then, it's a matter of now controlling the senses. Then he takes that firm resolution for doing that. Right? So then he can move out. It says then he may dwell in the forest. So unless he has that resolution, unless he has that controlled senses, he can't go and live in the forest like that. So that's the whole point here, is that it should be that the senses have been controlled the whole time. He has the firm resolution of going back to Godhead. In this relationship, then he sees that now I'm not engaging the senses into the fire of the sense objects. Right? Grihastha means the senses are engaged in the sense objects through religious principles, and that is the offering to the Lord. And through that, with that knowledge and that being offered to the Lord, that removes the desire to engage the senses in that way. So here now it's the opposite. Now he's still dealing with the senses, but now it's controlled. Right? The brahmachari controls his senses, but his emphasis is on study. And then the grihastha ashram, then he studied, so study goes on, but then the aspect of the senses. So then it's to engage the senses in the sense objects in the Lord's service. But now it's going to the next stage where he's still dealing with the senses, but not with the sense objects. Now he's restricting them from the sense objects, and he's contemplating the uselessness of it. Right? So then he's reversing the whole process. Right? And then we'll see in sannyas, and it goes back to what like the brahmachari was. So it's like one goes into this and then comes out of it. So it's a plan like that. So, yeah. Does that make some sense? So it's a whole, in other words, the focus is on the senses, like in the grihastha ashram, but not for engaging them, but for controlling them. Does that make sense? So seeing his wrinkled skin, hair white, should be seeing his skin wrinkled, okay. Seeing his skin wrinkled, his hair white, and grandsons, he may resort to the forest. So this is when, you know, if one wants to know when is the time, so this is kind of like, you know, this is the time. Happens before, fine, but at least by this time. Because if his grandsons are there, it means he's brought up his son properly. He's done his duty, he's brought up his son. Now his son is married, he has children. You know, so now he knows that his wife will be engaged. She can be here, she has the son to protect, she has grandchildren to take care of. So everything's there. So he's done his duty towards raising the family, right? Plus now he's getting old, his skin is getting wrinkled, so that means there's no more beauty in this and that, so there's no need to engage anymore in that direction. And his hair's gone white, so white hair is, means it's pukka, right? Means you just say gray hair, you know? But in the Indian languages, it's pukka, means it's gone mature. So once it's come to that point, then that means it's time to move on. Like that, you know? Like that. So now it's either committing his wife to his sons or accompanied by her. So then he may, if the situation is such and she's comfortable there, it's better for her, you know, the austerity in the forest would be too much for her, and she stays with the son. If not, then she can go with him. So we see both situations that are there. Sometimes we even see the women go off on their own, or with other women. And they go to the forest, you know, if there's nothing happening in the house. Like Kunti went off with Gandhari and Dhritarashtra and Vidura. Like that. The five of them went together to the forest. So as Gandhari was being taken care of, Dhritarashtra, and Kunti was being taken care of, Vidura. Like that. Because he's the uncle, you know. So it's like that. So they all went to the forest.
Did that? Kunti went with the...
Vidura, Dhritarashtra, and Gandhari. Remember when Dhritarashtra was living in the house after the Battle of Kurukshetra. And so he was there. Yudhishthira came back and he was no longer the emperor because Yudhishthira becomes the emperor, but he made him king of Hastinapur.
I don't remember Kunti going in that.
Yeah, she went also. She went along with him. Because she could tell this was the
end. There's no mention about it.
It's not in Bhagavatam, it's in Mahabharata.
Mahabharata.
Yeah, Mahabharata. Like that.
The same when Vidura took Dhritarashtra.
Yeah, so when Vidura told Dhritarashtra that, you know, he's just a dog living in the house of his, you know, his enemies, you know, like that. So then, you know, these are the very people you tried to get rid of your whole life and now you're living at their kindness. So that's not very nice. So when he made the determination to go, then Gandhari went with him. And then, since they were going, then Kunti went. She was already so detached, she was only eating once a month, and all she did was stay in her room and do puja and all that. She didn't do anything else. She was completely pulled back from the whole scene. Because she could see the whole diet, everything's wiped out, so it's like it wasn't worth it for her. So she went along with him. And then you also see that when, I'm not sure when it was, I think when Dhritarashtra was born, when Dhritarashtra was born, then Vyasadeva came to Satyavati and said, "Now is the end of the, you know, prosperity and glory of the Kuru dynasty. So better for you to go to the forest now than witness how the whole thing falls apart. You know, it'll be too much for you." Because she's from so much previous generation. She was actually the daughter of Uparicharavasu. Like that. So he's a previous king in the line. He goes way back. So he was, you know, very, very powerful. Then after that was that Santanu's father. Can't remember what his name is. And then Santanu. She was actually the daughter of Maharaj Uparicharavasu, very powerful, great, great king. So she was, means the king, yeah, you know that story? The king Uparicharavasu, he had been asked by his forefathers to go do a Shraddha, but that was just on the day time for conception for his wife had been planned. So then he went to the forest, he did whatever it was for the forefathers, but he was always thinking of the wife. And so in that thinking of the wife, then he discharged semen, and then that semen was given to a hawk to deliver to the queen, so that time of conception wouldn't be lost. So the hawk agreed to take it, but as he was taking, another hawk thought that he had something, you know, he had a rat or something like that.
So you got attacked by a second. The first hawk got attacked by a second one. So that semen was dropped and it fell in the water and that was eaten by a fish. It was an apsara that had been cursed to become a fish. So then the fisherman caught the fish, and the fisherman caught the fish, and then, you know, when he opened the fish up, he found two human babies inside. It was a boy and a girl. So then that was like too freaky to the fisherman. So he took that to the king. You know, anything special out of the ordinary always went to the king. Took it to the king. So the king could understand by the whole thing that this was his children. So then he kept the boy. The boy's name was Matsya, you know, obviously. And the girl's name was it means she became Satyavati later. That's because he gave the daughter to the fisherman. Said, you have the daughter since you were so kind to bring. And that she was also known as Matsyagandha because she smelled like a fish. Like that. He had quite a few names. So then she was the daughter of the fisherman that Santanu went mad after and then was married and then Bhishma and that whole thing like that. So she was from a previous time. So Vyasadeva just said, you won't be able to handle this. So she went to the forest with Ambika and Ambika and Ambalika. So the three of them, they went to the forest. So the principle is that if it's more favorable, then the wife will stay in the house with the sons. Everything's going nicely. If not, she'll go to the forest with the husband. Whatever is better. Like that. Let him wear a tattered garment. Let him bathe in the morning and evening. So let him not dress fancy. Fancy dressing, that's for the grihastha. And since he's in the forest, he's not preaching. So for himself, he won't wear anything nice. Grihastha has to wear nice. He has to be dignified. So if he has money, Manu mentions before, that if he has money, then he shouldn't wear ragged clothes. If he doesn't have money, then he wears ragged clothes. But if he has money, he has to dress properly. As much money as he has, he should dress properly. Like that. He doesn't have to be extravagant, but he should dress nicely. You know, he has money, he should be wearing, you know, good clothes, clean clothes, nice clothes, not worn out clothes. Like that. But as a vanaprastha, then he shouldn't wear. Then he should just wear old clothes. You know, because he's trying to break down the whole. In other words, you're trying to reverse the whole thing, all the prestige from the nice dressing, nice food, the social position, the interaction with women, trying to please the women, your economic development, all that you're reversing now. That's what's going on. You know, because in the brahmacharya ashram, then the guru's wife is working in the field of the husband. It means the gurukul is the husband's scene. She assists in that scene. It's not her field. In the inner chambers of the house, then the husband may go there. Then she's the boss of that area. But coming out of that into the gurukul, which means the rest of the house, he's the boss. He sets the standard. So it's a different thing. Sometimes it's said, well, grihasthas used to run the gurukuls, yes, but not with the woman leading the family. The man completely leads that. It's his call. She can assist. But in the household life, the man sets the field. He sets the field in which the activities will be done. But she calls the shot what activities are done, when. You know, she wants to do this now, or she wants to do that now. She's in the mood for this, she's in the mood for that. The activities that she can be in the mood for or not be in the mood for, that's set by the husband. But she still may set the mood. And that's a natural thing that happens. But in the gurukul, no. The husband sets the mood and that's the way it is. And if she's not in the mood, she can go into her part of the house and stay there. But it has nothing to do with the gurukul or the students. So we see there it's the man sets the field and sets the standards how it runs in the field. What mood it runs that day. Grihastha ashram, then the women set the mood. But vanaprastha reverses again. Again, the man, he just sets the mood and the wife has to go along with that. So if she's in that mood, she can go to the forest with him. If she's not, she should stay home. Because if she's at home, she's a grandmother, you know, like that, and she'll very much, you know, be part of the whole scene, giving directions, giving training, giving all that kind of thing in her own family. Because if she goes to the forest, then She's more detached from that. She's not running it day to day. It means the family may come ask advice. Other families will come and ask because these are mature grihasthas.
I don't know if it mentions it here. Yeah, it doesn't. The detail isn't here.
But where he goes, he can't go deep into the forest. Right? He'll either live on the outside edge of the village or the closest part of the forest. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Just out of the village in the forest, so he's accessible by the grihasthas. Or the outside edge, whichever is, you know, more comfortable for him, what's available. Like that. So it means they're accessible by the grihasthas. They can all come and ask advice and get, you know, direction and all that. Because they're mature. They've gone through it. They can tell you what to do. So they're still there. The sannyasis, they can leave and go right into the forest and be out of touch. But
the vanaprasthas have to be available. Like that. So in any case, whichever she's more attached to the family wants to be there, she'll be there. If not, she can go with the husband. And then she's more giving advice to all.
Does it mean that such a new one of Prasca, he's aware of his duty as an advisor for the
Prasca's family? It happens naturally.
Naturally.
It's natural. I mean, he's not sitting there waiting for, he doesn't put up a sign saying, you know, Grihasta, senior Grihasta advisor, you know, he doesn't, it's like that. Just, it's automatic that people will go to him because anyone who's generally detached, then someone who's attached feels that they could have a more balanced view of their situation, right? I mean, you go to another Grihasta, you may think they'll put their angle or spin on it, but someone who's detached won't. It's just a natural thing. Mm-hmm. So then vanaprasthas are a very important element of the social system. Right now, the sannyasis basically have to fill that gap because they're seen as detached. But it should be its vanaprasthas for these day-to-day grihastha difficulties and like that. Spiritual things, then you can go to them, or if it's something more, then the sannyasis. The sannyasis focus the most on spiritual. They're focusing on the bridging between the two.
That's why we have problem in our society that sannyasis are overloaded.
Yeah, it means we don't have three generations running us yet. You know, fully. It's supposed to be we have a retired grihastha class, but our grihasthas haven't retired yet. You know, that's the thing. It's our, you know, the elder devotees who are still in their 50s, they still haven't retired. They're still grihasthas. It should be at some point they retire. Then you have this whole, you know, group of persons that you have a great resource of experience from, and then they can give advice because once you pull back from it, you can see it in this clear light. Then you can give very good example. Then they can tell you, yeah, we tried that. This that, these things don't work. This works. Right now we don't have it. We have some brahmacharis, but the brahmachari ashram is not strong because you don't have the vanaprastha sannyas. Sannyas is there, but it's having to kind of, you know, cowtail to the whole grihasthasi. So the grihasthas are making themselves the prominent element, but they're setting the standard, and it's supposed to be the sannyasis and vanaprasthas set the standard. You know? And then the grihasthas, they follow that and propagate that. So before you had that mood of renunciation, detachment, but because of the lack of the culture and lack of understanding of the duties, then mistakes are made. Plus you have the, you know, aspect it's a material world, so even you do everything perfectly, it still doesn't work perfectly. It didn't work nicely for a lot of devotees, so then they naturally then reject it and say it doesn't work, but it's that they didn't operate it properly. So then it goes from detachment being the prominent to attachment is, you know, the standard. Not training, not detachment, not knowledge, not all the things that Krishna talks about in Gita. Attachment, what Krishna says, is the problem. So you can't base a social structure on something that's already the problem. You base your social structure on a problem, it's only going to create more problems. Krishna says, knowledge, detached activities done in knowledge with devotion, that's the solution to Arjuna's problem. Arjuna's professing attachment, or he's saying, because I'm attached now, I'm going to flip on the opposite side of the coin to, you know,
giving it all up, repulsion. But Krishna is saying it'll look the same. There's no difference. So it's that's not an advantage. He says what the point is do your duty with knowledge, with detachment for him. But that means then once you know, have knowledge about your duty, one is then you have something you're supposed to do. Two, when you have knowledge, it takes all the mystique out of it. So it's not as fun. Ignorance is bliss. You know what I'm saying? Knowledge is not known for creating bliss, because when you know, it's not as exciting. What you don't know is exciting. Right? Mm. Boys and girls get together when the lights are off, because you don't know what it is. The lights are on, then you know what it is, and the mystique's gone, and immediately the interest disappears very quickly. Understand? Mystique is very important. So that's why if you want to cut material energy, it's done with knowledge. The more you know about it, the less it looks attractive. Right? Then you have to, but then what happens is you don't want to do your duties. Right? Because of the fruit of nature, I do my duty because I want the result. If I don't want the result, which comes from knowledge, I don't do my duties. But Krishna said, that's what Arjuna is doing. Now that he knows he's going to lose everything, then he doesn't want to do it. Krishna is saying, no, you still have to do your duty. You can't not do your duty. Yeah, ma karma, ma karma, I hate the word, ma stay sango, still karma. Means you can't not do your duty. So you have to do the duty. But now you're doing the duty because you're supposed to do it. So you're doing it from a detached point of view. This is a very important thing, because otherwise the normal thing is I do it because I want the result, I don't want the result, I don't do it. That's the normal karma kandi thing. Mm-hmm. Or going from karma to jnana. But bhakti is different. Bhakti is I'm doing my duties of karma with the knowledge of jnana, but for neither goal, but for bhakti's goal. So that's a completely different thing. It's something unheard of by the conditioned soul. I want, I do. I don't want, I don't do. So that's your karmas and jnanas. But I don't want, and I do. So that's very opposite of everything else. So then, that's something completely different. So they're in vanaprasthas, they're performing their duty, but they're unattached. So automatically, then here's somebody you can go to. So when that comes, then that's very nice. So that will come. But right now, while attachment is the prominent thing, and grihastha life is the prominent thing, and within that, then the women are the prominent. Then, how is it going to be a problem? How is it going to work? Women don't go to women for advice. You know? Unless they're detached. Then they go to them. So, grandmothers are always more detached. You know? I was talking with one grandmother. I said, how is it that the grandmothers can put in more time and energy into the kids, grandchildren, than the mothers can put into them as their own kids? It says because they're not yours. You know, things go too crazy, it's their kids. So because of that detachment, you're able to put in that time. Because it's up to them. How they want it to run, it's up to them. We simply give advice. We know, we've gone through it. We give advice. This is how you should do it, that's how you do it. But it's their kids, so therefore, if they don't do it, that's their problem. So they're more aloof. So because of that, then you can go to them and ask, and you know that they're not laying a trip. They're just saying, this is what you can do. You do it, it works. You don't do it, you know, have fun. You know, they understand youth, you know, they're nuts. So then they want to do it, go ahead, go for it, enjoy, you know. Then you'll see what we're saying is exactly the way it is. And like that. Then they have nothing to gain, so, you know, they come back later, yeah, you were right, and they don't say, I told you so. It's like, yeah, and then they move on. So that kind of mood is very much appreciated. So that's the importance of the vanaprastha ashram. Because it can give that bridge between the grihastha, and the, you know, the mundane, the dutiful mundane, and the transcendental. Because they're working in both fields. They're endeavoring now directly for the transcendental, but they've been through the mundane. So they're a very good bridge. You know? So until your social system has all these four in place, it won't happen. Right? So once you get the vanaprasthas, then the vanaprasthas will understand, yes, it's very important that we have brahmacharis. Right? Sannyasis will say, but sannyasis are doing their own thing. You know, they naturally will say. They're always opposed to grihastha ashram, this, that. They don't understand. They don't know the reality. They can't say that about vanaprasthas. You know, they can't level those complaints about vanaprasthas. You know? So therefore, then your brahmacharya ashram will become strong. Right? When you have them, then you have this. Because sannyasis already are there to make it strong, but then the grihasthas have to have faith there. So they'll have faith in the sannyasis when the vanaprasthas are able to inspire them.
What does it mean? What do you mean brahmacharya ashram is strong?
Strong.
In us?
Strong.
Strong. In the
right now, it's the idea is everyone's going to get married anyway, so why bother with brahmachari life?
Oh.
But the point is first class brahmachari makes a first class grihastha. Mm. So if they're not a brahmachari, then they're not a grihastha, they're a grihamedi. Guaranteed. Grihastha doesn't mean married. Grihastha means more important is the house than Krishna. You come to Janmashtami once a year, you know, that's generally a grihamedi. It doesn't mean you're not a devotee. It just means that Krishna's next in line after the house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing. Generally, we take grihamedi to be some disgusting, low class, you know, gross materialist. No, it just means that your priorities are not right. Right? It means you stretch the definition. Anyone married is called a grihastha. But if you want to get right down to the detail, then the grihamedis. You take someone like Maharaj Prachina Barhishad. Right? You'd say he's a grihastha, but technically he's a grihamedi, because he's just doing karmakanda. There's no purpose for Krishna, for us. There you can say he was doing for higher purpose of the heavenly planet, so therefore he has a higher purpose. So sacrifice is important for him. So the center of his life is sacrifice, but that's still just to enjoy grihastha life. So God's not the center. God's progressive laws are the center of his life, but God himself directly is not. So technically you can say he's a grihamedi, because it's still grihastha life is his center. Even the jnani you can say. Right? So only the bhakta, then Krishna goes to center. But if Krishna gets put second in the concept, you know, later, yes. Right now it's more important these things. Then that's grihamedi. Because medi means what is the center. Right? So when it's griha medi, they're called a grihamedi. When it's Krishna medi, that's called a grihastha.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like Bhagavatam definition. The general definition is different. Just like someone who performs sinful activities is called, you know, a sinful person. A Vishayi, materialist. But someone who performs pious activities, they're called, you know, a religious person. They're pious. They follow the scriptures, they're pious. So that's the general definition. But when you get to the Bhagavatam definition, then anyone who they perform activities to please Krishna, they're pious. And anyone who doesn't, even if it's following the scriptures and they're Mr. Pious in the material world, they're all considered impious. So any fruitive worker is called impious, whether he's following the scriptures or not. And those who make Krishna, they're doing the activity for Krishna, they're called pious. So that's the higher, that's the transcendental definition. You know, so that follows the, you know, so for us that includes, you know, grihasthas, everybody. It doesn't matter. Anybody who's doing it for Krishna, they're a transcendentalist. And anyone who's not is not. They're sinful. So it's taking it up to the next level. So it's a matter of whether you form your definition this side of the Viraja or that side. Right? Means, in other words, what's on the other side of the Viraja is pious, what's on this side is sinful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you're doing your activities for Krishna, that's considered pious. Right? So then devotees are pious. Right? Even if they are griha-medhi, still they're pious. But the materialists, who may be doing all things perfectly following the Veda, perfectly pious, are impious because they're not doing anything for Krishna. The real purpose of piety is to please Krishna. Does that make sense? So in that same kind of way, then you take it as what is actually transcendental, naishkarmya. That's proper. And if it's not naishkarmya, then that's less. And if the sakam takes Krishna out of the center, that becomes griha-medhi. Nishkam is automatically Krishna as the center. Sakam, you can still have Krishna as the center, but you want to enjoy. You want facility. But if Krishna is not the center there, and you want your facility, then that's called griha-medhi.
One can say that vihaska is actually on the level of madhyama.
Can also be on the neophyte. I'm saying sakam, as long as Krishna is still the center. You see that people will go to Krishna for everything. Mm. Even though it's material, but they're going to Krishna. So that's great in grihastha. By our definition. Mm. Because devotees are grihasthas, non-devotees are not, are griha-medhis. Right? So that means also, if the devotee makes Krishna second, then he is griha-medhi. Though he's still a devotee. So there's a combination between the two. Mm-hmm. It's like the junction. Because he's a devotee, then if he keeps good association, doesn't commit any offense, then he'll come up to the standard with time. Because how long can you go after the material energy as a devotee? Once you know what the standard is, it's very hard to take seriously the material energy. You see, even some of the most ardent, you know, devotees who go back into material energy, they don't last more than about 10 years. They have to come back. And it's just, they know too much. You know? They've tasted too much. So it's just, they find no taste for material energy. So that's the thing, is that's why it's no big deal. That's the importance of vanaprastha. When they're grihasthas, and that, then they may take this way, that way, and so it's all, oh, this, it's the end of the world, this, that. The vanaprastha just know these things happen, these ups and downs. So they're much more balanced. Like that.
Okay. So he's not interested in prestige, he's not interested in facility, you know, he just lets. Let him bathe in the morning and evening, so he should be very clean and, you know, regulated. Let him honor those who come to his hermitage. So that means he's still hosting guests and everything. Because then once you're vanaprastha, people, the grihasthas will come to you because they come for advice, and the other sages will come to you because now you're worth talking to. You know? As a grihastha, they'll come to your house for a half hour, you know, just to, you know, beg something and, you know, and give a little bit of knowledge. But they won't come to your house and stay there and talk with you and interact. But here, now as a vanaprastha, they will. Because now you're detached like they are. Your purposes are the same as them. Because most of the sages, they're basically vanaprasthas. You know? The Brahmins who live in the forest, then they're more detached than the ones in the city. So they can relate to the vanaprasthas. You know? And a lot of them, they're like vanaprasthas living in the forest. They're not sannyasis, but they're not grihasthas. You know? That's why they're there, and you can see as they interact more with the grihasthas. Does that make sense? You know, they have these rishis like that. Like Vyasadeva is a rishi, but he's called upon for niyoga with his sister-in-laws. It's not against the rules because he's not a sannyasi. Mm-hmm. And he's not a brahmachari. But he's not technically as such a grihastha. You know, they're just detached. So they're kind of in that realm of they're just detached. Does that make any sense? I think at some point Vyasadeva was also married, because otherwise how would it be Sukadeva? But it's kind of like they're detached, they live in the forest. So those kind of Brahmin grihasthas and the vanaprasthas, then they'll get on very well. You know, the sannyasis will come, the other sages.
So then he will take care of those who come. Let him recite the Veda, be patient, friendly, of collected mind, and liberal. So he should be studying the Veda, he should be patient, right? Because that's the thing, is trying to be dynamic in grihastha life, sometimes patience may get less because you want the result, but here you're not wanting results, so therefore then patience becomes more prominent. Friendly, because now he's not considering all the social different things, prestige and all that, so he should be friendly. And of collected mind, so that means he'll really much think about what he's doing, what is his purposes. And liberal means he'll always get extra things, and all, he should give that in charity. Because all these different people will visit him, they'll give him things. So then all the excess, then he should be giving away. Shouldn't be then collecting and trying to, you know, create another whole grihastha scene. It means how much he needs, what his vow is how much he keeps, that much he keeps, the rest he gives away. So that's you know, so he should be very charitable. Eating habits. Let him eat vegetables, flowers, roots, fruits, and the production of pure trees. In other words, pure vegetarian. So your brahmachari, your grihastha, and your brahmachari, your vanaprastha, sannyas in the Vedic culture, even if the karmakandis, has to be vegetarian. Your grihastha, for the purpose of sacrifices, might not be in the other three ages, Nisatya, Treta, and Dwapara, because they'd be doing an animal sacrifice, like that. So then, in that, the horse is offered in sacrifice, and it would be cooked and eaten, because that's how you get the karma. Right? The karma of the horse has to go to the priest and the yajna, because he's a horse. We discussed this before. No? He's a horse because of bad karma. So for him to be elevated to the human form and the heavenly planets means he has to have been removed of all his sins that make him a horse. So those sins have to go somewhere. They go to the priest and the Ajna. Right? So that also, unless people are doing sadhana and all that, they can't do these sacrifices. That's why in this age they're forbidden, because people will just go to hell. They won't chant the mantras right, the horse won't make it to the heavenly planets, they'll eat the horse, they'll get all the bad karma, and they'll go to hell. Right? So the horse will have to take birth as a horse, and the person who did the horse sacrifice will go to hell. You know? So there'll be no benefit in this age. You know? And besides that, as we can see from the Bhagavatam, all the karmakanda, it's, you know, what's the big deal? You go to the heavenly planets, you come back again. So it's no big deal. Therefore, transcendence is the real thing. So in this age, they just bypass all this other bewildering thing, just go straight to the essence, which is Hari Nam Sankirtan.
How does it work, this cow or horse sacrifice? And they eat actually the flesh?
Yeah, it's part of it is eaten. I don't think they eat the whole thing.
It's like a symbolic thing, or just...
Yeah, I think it would be more symbolic in the sacrifices. In the shraddhas, it's actually cooked as a preparation. But they don't generally use... There's all kinds of animals that are used. None of the ones that are commonly eaten by people. Deers and this and that, all kinds of things. But pigs and cows and chickens, these things aren't, you know, used in... Yet in shraddhas. There's a whole list of what can be. Porcupines, I think, are cool.
what about when we hear that actually the horse comes with the rejuvenated body out, or something comes out with the rejuvenated body?
That's how they test the mantra.
So
that's how they tell that it means they want to test if these Brahmins are good. Then they build a fire. You know, like a sacred fire. They take an old cow, and then holding the tail, they push it into the fire, and when they pull it back out, they pull out a young cow.
Really?
A calf, yeah. Then they can tell, these guys know what they're doing. Because the point is that horse or cow goes to the heavenly planets, you go. It doesn't go, you go to hell. So the kings have to be really sure that these Brahmins know what they're doing.
So with the cow and with the horse is also doing the same with this thing of the tail?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's just that you know that they're there. The Brahmins were that powerful.
Because and then they sacrifice this young cow.
That or some other, whatever it is for that. This is just checked. Because the horse sacrifice, the horse is killed. You know who kills it?
Who kills it?
Yeah, the queen.
Only the queen.
Yeah, the queen, the king's wife, you know, the first wife, the one that he goes to the sacrifice with, she has three chops with the sword to get the head off. She doesn't get it off, the whole sacrifice is ruined, they all go to hell.
So she must be pretty muscular.
Well, they're Kshatriyas. Generally, only Kshatriyas do these things. You don't hear Vaishyas doing horse sacrifices. Brahmins don't do it.
Three shots.
Yeah, I mean, she should get off in one shot, but she's got three to get it off.
Off clean.
Yeah, clean. And then she gets to sleep next to it at night in the Yajnashala during the night. And depending on the dreams and stuff that are there, then those are interpreted, and then they decide, you know, the auspiciousness or not of the sacrifice.
And this is only for horse.
That's the horse sacrifice. I'm not sure how the cow one works, but I just know the ashramate is like that. So in other words, you know, there's some wild stuff going on there.
What's the principle of having these horses or these cows anyway involved? What's the principle?
I'm not sure. It's something, see, there has to be ritual that's there. People, the more the materialism, the greater the ritual has to be, and the more technical and difficult it has to be. Well, the more septic the things are, I mean, the more that you're not interested in results, then the more simple it can be. So that's the thing, it's a very complex thing, it's a very serious thing. You have to get the horse has to have certain lakshanas, very hard to get. It's not any old horse, you know, it has to have special symptoms to it and all that. And so then, you know, these, they're all hard to get. And then you have to, the horse goes out around wherever it goes and those kings have to pay tribute or there has to be a fight. What if you're defeated? Then you don't have a horse sacrifice. So you've got to defeat all the all the kings in the area where that horse wanders, you know, and then when they come back to the kingdom, then you can have the sacrifice of that horse. So it's very, very complicated. All the, you know, items you have to get, you know, mud from two sides of the river, you have to get it from the top of a mountain, you have to get it from an anthill, you have to get it from here, you have to get it. The list of ingredients is mind-boggling. So kings have that facility. They just send men all over India to get all these different things. And so, you know, so it's a big thing.
And Yudhisthira did that?
Yeah. Well, his is not Ashwamedha, his is Rajasuya. So they don't send the horse. They just go around and it's... Because the horse may not go to every kingdom. But whatever kingdom it goes to, then they have to do. So that means it's a great thing in Ashwamedha. But Rajasuya means every king on the planet has to accept the sovereignty of that. So that means they got to go and either the person respects and automatically surrenders, or he fights.
I mean, the civilized world or the old world? I mean, they went to South America and pet?
Means whatever is in Bharatvarsha.
Okay.
Means Bharat and means in the Bharatakanda, you know? So you see that. It basically went, you know, as far as the, what do you call it, as far west as I think like Afghanistan and that, because after that's desert. But you would see is, because Gandhar is Afghanistan, so you'd have over there. There they go all the way south, north they go up into the Himalayas, up to the upper, you know, the, up where the, up to where the northern Kurus live, because then that turns into all the mystical stuff. So humans can't go in there. You know, they passed the Ganda Mandana and everything. And then in the west, the east, they went, it seemed to be as far as Manipur and those areas. Because after that, then I think it's, you know, too much tribal. So that's the main area that they have to deal with.
That's empire.
Yeah. Well, that's quite big. But still, they had, you know, it always mentions that some of the kings, that's good enough, you know, for that's there. But you hear of kings of previous times, like Uparicharavasu and some of these others, they had sovereignty over all the seas and islands. So islands meaning here continents. You know, because they could fly around and go to all these places so naturally. But here it's like that's as far as you can go. You can't go across the desert, you can't go across the Himalayas. You can't cross the ocean. They don't go down to Didishan. You know? And I don't know what's on the other side. I think it's just all, you know, it's like when you get to Burma, it's just jungle. Burma, Thailand, oh, it's just jungle. You know, you have in Tibet, that's all the yakshas, so they go there. But, you know, there's only so far past the Himalayas you can go. So that would be what's there. And after that, it's just wild men. Because you see these other things when they come up big and strong, you still, you know, you have kind of like civilizations now in China, Thailand, and those things. But those are much more recent. Those don't go back so far. Chinese goes back some ways, but they were small.
I heard one of arguments of Madhvacharya against Karmakandis was that if you were, you know, if you perform such animal sacrifice, why not let you perform the sacrifice of your father so you can send your father to heaven?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying we have nothing good to say about it. Mm. But the point is that people are,
at least they're following the scriptures for the purpose of their enjoyment. If they want enjoyment, then they should work for it.
You know, and these are the scriptural things, is that horse will go to the heavenly planets. Mm-hmm. And the person who performs it will go to the heavenly planets. But the downside is, mung saha, I kill you, you kill me. So at some point, that person who went to the heavenly planets comes back, and the horse comes back. Then the horse is the king, and the king is the horse.
That's also there.
Yeah, that's the whole point of mung saha.
Even in the Ashwamedha.
Yeah, because I kill you, you kill me. That's the meaning of me.
Does it mean that it can be also applied to Indra because he performed 100 Ashwamedhas? So one
all
point.
All these things. Yeah, that's the whole point of samsara, from what I understand. Because the point is in the Vedas, eating of meat is never sanctioned unless the animal has been offered in sacrifice.
In this case, I mean, the king is not, I mean, it's not doing it for eating some horse meat.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's, you're doing it for sacrifice, and the remnants of the sacrifice happen to be non-vegetarian. You know? So there is no sin. It doesn't mean there's not a reaction. See, that's the whole point. Karmakanda, you know, points out there's no sin, but finesses that there's no reaction. The Upanishads point out there's reaction. Mm. You know, like that. But Manu also points it out. He also points out that mamsaha, saha, there is reaction. You'll be the animal to be killed by the animal then becoming, you know, by that same animal. So that is reaction. And it points out is whatever it is, even a sacrifice, it's remnants of the sacrifice, but still the origin of flesh and how you got it into that position as meat is disgusting. Right? I mean, you start up. All flesh starts on seed and ovum. Not very palatable. Right? They're considered impure substances. You know, the 12 excretions of the body, you know, semen comes into the 6 that are completely impure. You have to you take a bath, purify yourself. Mm-hmm. It's not in the 6 that you just wash your hands, you know, like tears or sweat or, you know, something from your nose or ears or the little stuff in the corner of your eyes or saliva. That you just wash your hands and do ashram. But this other, you know, I mean, stool, urine, semen, blood, fat, marrow, that you have to, you know, purify yourself, take a bath, do the whole thing. So that's what you're starting with. All flesh comes from there. Then to get it into the stage where it's, you know, edible, means you had to use violence to kill it. Though, because it's being killed according to sacrifice, it's technically not violence, because violence means what is detrimental. But here, it's progressive, because they'll be elevated in heavenly planets. So from that side, it's not, you're not being violent that it's against scriptures, but still, the mentality of violence has to be used.
So So that's why there is always dangers to make this step over the line, to make mistake. In
yeah, because if anything is done wrong, it's like you've killed this animal.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you've killed it, it's not done properly, then everyone goes to hell. So therefore, that's why it's so. And even if you've done it properly, the animal is waiting for you. That's what was pointed out to Prachina Bharhishad. He had all these animals, these rurus, waiting together. So these are all the downsides that aren't pointed out. Because someone, when they've got so much desire, they're blind. Anyone can tell them you shouldn't do this, but they're blinded by attachment and desire. So therefore, at least do it in a pious way. That's the whole point. Does that make sense? So at least it's progressive. You have desire, you're totally enchanted by material energy, but at least don't deal with the material energy in such a way that it won't be progressive. You should still have your guru, you should respect your gurus, you should perform sacrifice, you should give them charity, you should be austere, you should follow the scriptures, because then one day when you wake up and understand this is nonsense, then you'll still have a guru now, but now a transcendental guru rather than a karmakanya guru. Right? You'll still respect them, you'll give them charity, you'll be austere. You know, the scriptures now, you'll follow the transcendental scriptures. So the form of it stays the same. The detail changes. But if they don't do that, then they'll just be sinful. They'll go out, kill animals, eat them, go out, have, you know, illicit sex with anybody and anything, anywhere. You know, they'll be violent, they'll gamble, they'll just do all nonsense, they'll be intoxicated, everything. So if they have attachment for these things, it has to be regulated. By that regulation, they don't cause any trouble, they're elevated, and eventually they'll give it up. The karmi eventually turns into a jnani. Right? Like that. So there is a progression. Like that. But it's slow. Therefore, the path of bhakti is the direct path. You just take it up one lifetime, you go back to Godhead. These guys take millions of lifetimes to move through karma, millions of lifetimes through jnana, like it mentioned in the Brahma Samhita. Millions of lifetimes of drilling the respiration. The yogis can't see even the reflection off the tips of the toenails of the Lord. So millions of lives. So that means this is going on. Someone's a yogi for millions of lifetimes, practicing the pranayama, perfecting each lifetime a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. You know, I think Prabhupada mentioned about these top musicians who are just so excellent. He says they've been doing this for lifetimes. That's why they're good. Otherwise, you don't get good like that in one lifetime. Bhakti, yes. Material things, no. Because the focus has to be so perfect. So that means you have to be so convinced. That means you have to cut it out everywhere else. You know, it has to be music as your life, or your yoga, or your jnana, or your karma as your life. So then, that takes a lot of lifetimes. Otherwise, how do you keep people busy here from time immemorial? You have to keep them busy eternally. So that means they got to move through it slowly. Otherwise, they get bored real quick. So that's what I said. Someone who takes up devotional service, they've done all this and they're sick of it because they've seen it hasn't gotten us where it is. So all you're dealing with is residue. You're not dealing with heavy stuff. They don't really have faith in any material. They may have the habit of dealing with it, right? But to them, they understand it's not good. The devotee's not saying meat eating is good. He's not saying intoxication or illicit sex or gambling is good. Sometimes he may fall back into these habits. But he doesn't say they're good. It's just by habit. But those who are not through with this cycle, they'll say it's good. They'll say it's great. You know? So the devotee's been through all this and decided this is not where it's at. But by habit, it's still there. So if he's very determined, then very quickly he can get rid of it. But if he's not so determined, he may get distracted. You know, then they go to the heavenly planets, they come back down. So if they're focused but they don't make it, they're born in the family of devotees. But if they're not so focused, then they go to the heavenly planets and come down in their families, the aristocracy. That makes sense. Yeah.
If I properly understand, there's a difference between karmakanda, jnanakanda, and like upasana. It's different kind of mentalities. So
slightly. It's all materialistic. It's just a matter of what is the method. One is attachment, one is detachment. Jnanakanda means their attachment is detachment. The karmakanda means their attachment is attachment.
So if like let's say to see the like in the life of devotees, like we have like karma mission bhakti jnana mission bhakti, so it might be also like one follows regulative principles just because he's benefited by such principles. He gets something good for himself, some elevation or maybe liberation. So that means he gets also reactions. I mean, like, okay, I offer Krishna my food stuff because I don't want to get reactions. So that's
one level.
And so that means also it brings some kind of reactions.
Any activity done in the material world, you get a result. The point is whether the result is yours or not. If you consider it yours, you get the reaction. If you consider it Krishna's, reaction is still there, but you're unaffected by it. You become liberated by that unattached work. But if you're doing it for yourself, then you become attached. It's only by giving the result to Krishna after that you free yourself. So if you don't give it to Krishna, you're bound by it. So the Naishkarma means before you start, the result is Krishna's. Therefore, by doing the activity, you're free there. You don't have to wait for the result, because the result's Krishna. Any action gives a reaction. It's just the way material energy works. Any activity is only done for a goal. There's no such thing as anyone acting outside of that. You always work because there's a result there. But the devotee is working because the result's for Krishna. And if he's more attached, then he does the result because it's for himself, and he'll give some of it to Krishna. And the materialist does it because he'll get the result for himself. So result is always there, and so because the result, therefore you perform the activity. So if you follow the scriptures and the result you want, then the activity to get that result is mentioned in the scriptures. Because otherwise, how do you know what result, what activity to do to get what result? You don't know how. How do we know how the material energy works? That's the point. So the scriptures have to tell us. You want this result, you do this activity. Otherwise, how would... People are trying to go to heaven, you know, but what are they doing? They go to the church once a week, and, you know, they're nice, and sometimes they may, you know, thank God for the bread. You know, so it's something pious. Right? But technically, the heavenly planets, they got to do a little bit more than that. You know? Serious giving and charity, austerity, you know, and all this comes from knowledge, not just sentiment. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it's not so scientific. But here the scriptures directly say, whatever you want, then these are the methods. So then by performance of bhakti, you can get those things if you want. That would be foolish. That probably gives an example. You go to the millionaire and ask him for, you know, 1 rupee. You know, that means you can perform bhakti, go back to Godhead. You perform bhakti, you just stay here. You know, that's the use. Does that make sense? Yeah. Make any sense? Any questions on this? Or?
Vanaprastha.
Will you continue on the Vanaprastha?
Yeah, because we still have all this. Mm. Means on Friday we'll continue.
Because traditionally, other ashrams are more kind of clear cut, brahmachari, grihastha, in whatever, but at least merit, at least have a vivayak, and sannyas, of course. Vanaprastha, is there any like yagya or like a.
No. Because it's basically. Technically, it's just a continuation of the grihastha ashram, but now in a detached mood. So at one point, the grihastha ashram has to be formed in a detached mood if you want to be progressive.
But it's also it's a question of consciousness mainly, yeah. But of you're, course also you're, the
you're
social aspects.
Yeah, but you're changing your mentality from engaging the senses and the sense objects to pulling the senses out of the sense objects.
Which actually, I mean, as Trigriyasta should already be doing already.
But still he's engaging the senses and the sense objects. Like that, but he may be doing it in a detached mood. Here he's not engaging the senses and the sense objects in a detached mood. So the benefits of the vanaprast, the grihastha can be getting.
So that's the essence of vanaprastha, being like pulling off.
Yeah, in other words, all the things that are there in all opulences, he's pulling back from them. So he's directly not wanting to deal with them. Sannyas means, we'll see later, he's neutral. Right? Grihasthas, I mean, vanaprastha specifically doesn't eat anything good. You know, by the traditional thing. You know, they go to the forest, they just eat the fruits and roots are there. They just, you know, he has the whole thing. He can either grind it himself, he can cook it, or he can not cook it and grind it, or he can just use his teeth as a grind. He can take the raw grains and just put them in his mouth and chew on them. You know, depending how it means, this it means the whole vanaprastha gets more and more and more and more austere. So he lives in a house, he does all his yagyas, then eventually he gives up the yagyas and just does it by the mind. Then by the, you know, like this, he gradually takes it out. He stops in the house, he goes out and stands outside. He stands out in the rain, he stands out in the cold, he stands out in the wind, he stands out like that. And still, eventually, he doesn't live in the house. He just lives outside. So he just does more and more severe austerities. Either by a fixed plan that I'll do it for this many years, and then after that goes on to sannyas, or he just does it until his body can't handle the austerities anymore, and he leaves his body.
And this is mainly for brahmanas or for vijas? Because kshatriya takes it on the cross, I'm not
thinking. No, but you see, kshatriyas do this also. Vaishyas could. Means in the tradition they may or may not. But as devotees, then generally Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they all take sannyas. They all go all the way up to there. But otherwise, you'd see the Brahmins would do all four, Kshatriyas 3, Vaishyas 2, and Shudra 1. Means the Dvijas all are Brahmacharis, then they go Grihastha. Then the sannyasis and Brahmins would go to Vanaprastha, and the Brahmins would go to sannyas. Grihastha, Shudras are always Grihastha. They never go to Gurukul. They're just always grihasthas. So even though they're unmarried, they're still basically grihasthas. They're just unmarried. They're bachelors. You know, that's all.
You were saying sannyasis are neutral in the sense that, what sense? They don't look for the austerity?
They don't. It doesn't matter. It means if there's something nice to eat, they eat it. If there's not something nice to eat, they don't care. It's not that the vanaprastha would specifically try to be austere. The sannyasi, he just takes whatever comes. He travels, he preaches, and he goes to a king's house, he gives him royal food, he eats that. It's not that he doesn't eat it, oh, I'm a sannyasi, I don't eat it. Right? Because that's still repulsion. So that means there's still some attraction and repulsion. Here they're supposed to come to the point of neutrality. They don't care. Right? They don't care if they live or die. If they're alive, they perform sadhana. They die, they go back to Godhead. So they're never endeavoring for that. What they're trying to do is just pull themselves out of the material energy. But they're not using the material on it. That'll come. We'll see it like this.
So in one sense, I mean, in terms of ISKCON sociology, vanaprastha, in one sense, they're the ones more difficult to define or to categorize.
Because it is easy as long as you can define grihasthas. If you can define the grihastha, you can define the vanaprastha. But the problem is devotees haven't been able to define grihastha. Because on one side, you know, previously it was just, you know, gross sense gratifiers. And now it's, you know...
Previously to what?
You know, I mean, up to probably the early 80s, then grihasthas meant, you know, gross sense gratifiers. You know, from 73 to probably about 81, grihasthas were gross sense gratifiers. Before 73, they were just, you know, a respected member of the society. You know, from, you know, 66 to 72, they were just, you know, just part of the scene, you know. And then from 73 until 81, then, you know, they were second-class citizens. then in 81, 82, then the grihasthas are the superior senior, you know, members of society, and all the other ones are just, you know, dishonest, you know, out of it. They should be grihasthas, but they're not honest enough to admit it. So, you know, the whole thing has to balance properly. It's just very, very funny. So, before it was, and the grihasthas were there, the whole mood was nishkam, but nishkam to the point of, you know, not even functioning as grihasthas. And now it's sakam to the point of not functioning as grihasthas. So the point is they have to come to the balance of the middle and be grihasthas that follow properly the nishkam. And for those who can't, they follow the sakam properly. So you have that range. Within the grihastha, you have sakam and nishkam. Brahmacharya vanaprasthanyas is only nishkam. There is no such thing as sakam. Grihasthas should be nishkam. If they're not, then be sakam but connected to Krishna, and eventually work towards becoming nishkam. Because if they don't respect those who are following nishkam, they'll never get out of it. The grihastha who doesn't respect the renounced orders will never get out of grihastha life. They'll always be entangled. Like that. They can't progress because you don't value it. Right? You respect what you value. You know, like Yudhishthir respects those kings, the great kings. He's always asking about defining and tell the histories of the great kings because they're inspiring, and then that makes him a better king. But if he thinks he's the great king and everybody else is not, he can never become a great king. So you have to respect what it is you're trying to get to. Your goal has to be respected. So therefore, if the detachment, unless it's respected, you can't get to it. So the grihastha doesn't respect the sannyasis, the brahmacharis, the manaprasth for that detachment, himself can never become detached. He'll always be bound. You know, it's just like you can't be a leader unless you can follow. It's the same principle. The best leaders are the best followers. Like that. So you see, Yudhishthira is completely surrendered to the Brahmins. Completely surrendered to his seniors. You know, like Dhritarashtra is the king. You know? So therefore, if Dhritarashtra doesn't make any comment about the gambling match, even though it's completely unfair and is nonsense, then what can you say? If he says you go to the forest, he goes to the forest, even though it's not right, because he respects his seniors. Therefore, the world respects Yudhishthira. But Dhritarashtra doesn't respect his seniors because he never follows their advice. He seemingly respects them by etiquette, but he never listens to them. He never really follows what they say. Therefore, the world doesn't respect Dhritarashtra. You know, Vidura, Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, you know, Vyas, Markandeya, they're all telling him what to do. He can't do it. Because of attachment. Because Yudhishthira is detached, he has respect, therefore he's the emperor of the world. Everybody respects him. Like that. Duryodhana wants to go out, if by force he has to make himself the king. Yudhishthira, many just, oh, it's Yudhishthira's the king, yes. We'll accept him as the emperor. And then those who are demoniac, then they'll fight. But you find many who are even demoniac, they just respect his qualities. You know, I think Shishupal and the other, they didn't fight. I don't even think Karna fought. When they went around for the Rajasuya.
That's...
You know, because they have to go around and conquer all the kings, they have to get tribute from them all. You know? The northern Kurus, they didn't fight. They just immediately said, what do you want? He said, Yudhishthira wants to do the Rajasuya, so he wants tribute. He said, fine. So that's what freed.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the things that upset Duryodhana so much, is he said, They even got tribute from the northern Kurus. Nobody gets tribute from the northern Kurus. Nobody can even go there, let alone get tribute from them. Arjuna went there and got tribute from them without a fight. So like that was too difficult for Yudhishthira to, I mean Duryodhana to digest that. Completely upset. You know, it's just all these kings just willingly surrendered to Yudhishthira. You know? And then when he has the opening of his sabha, half the universe was there. Narad Muni was there, Vyasa was there, Gautama, Markandeya, all the big rishis and the Muni, they're all there. They all come. They come with him when he first walks in, when he does the Griha Pravesh. They're all there, they sit, they talk like this. And all that, so that kind of stuff is just too much for Duryodhana. I mean, they don't come to his place, you know. Maybe if they invite them, but here they just show up. We heard, you know, you're opening a new sabha, they want to see you. Like that. So it's just because he can follow, therefore he's the leader of everybody. So that's the whole point, is therefore the Naishkarmi is, if you respect the renounced order or the position of renunciation, then that Grihastha will progress towards that and he will become himself. But if he doesn't respect, he'll never become. He'll always be entangled. Because detachment is progressive. Attachment's not. Because attachment's based on control. And control means we're in control, we're not the instrument. So that means we're not accepting our position as jivas. Jivas, by construction, are instruments. They're not subject, they're not object. They're instruments. That's the whole point. Krishna is subject, his internal potency is object, and the jivas are instruments. That's the way they're made. So if we want to be the controller, it means we think we're God. Because he's the controller. And he is the enjoyer. So that's the problem. That's why it's at least then follow the rules, because then you're accepting that there's something, even though if you put a person behind it or not, at least there's an authority for you. And you have to have a guru to understand the scriptures. So at least you put yourself, I'm servant to somebody, maybe not God, but at least you're the principle that I'm subservient to somebody, and I'm humble, and I accept I got to follow their direction. And it may be short during the time of that sacrifice you're in that mood. But at least you've done that much, it's a step forward. But for the devotee, then, he is servant of Krishna, therefore he's instrument, therefore he's not in control, therefore he's not attached. Does that make sense? If the sambandha is wrong, your prayojana has to be wrong. Because prayojana is the maturation of sambandha. When you have desire, that matures into attachment. And what you're attached to, that's what you work towards. That's your avideya. Right? The mind goes thinking, feeling, then willing. Right? It thinks about it. So then it desires it. When it desires it, then it's feeling. It wants it. It has attachment or need. Then the abhideya happens. So if your sambandha is not, I am Krishna's servant, but I am the controller, then that means then your prayojana, your attachment, is not to Krishna, but it's the material energy. Because you can only be controller of material energy. So then your activity will be mundane. Guaranteed. But now, if you're on the platform of Sakam, then when you get the result of your mundane activity, you'll give the result to Krishna. So that elevates you. If you don't give it to Krishna, you have no hope. But if I'm servant of Krishna, therefore the attachment is to Krishna's happiness, therefore the activity you perform is actually spiritualized. Because then the result is Krishna's. So the result's already given before you started. So that's nishkam. You know, so it's very scientific. So that's the whole thing, that's sambandhabhidhaya praja. So that's why it always mentions control, gain and safety, you know, control and attachment, envy and attachment. Right? Control, envy, they're the same thing. Because your enviousness of the Lord, you want to be the controller rather than Him. So envy is the mood that creates it. Control is the cause of it. You know? I mean, is the how you say? Is the quality you want? You're envious of His control, and therefore, because of His control, the enjoyment. So you're envious of that. That creates fear. So you can have control, envy, fear. They're all in that same. They all mean the same thing. They're just taken from different things. Because of that, then you're fearful of my relationship that I am servant of God. And that creates the fear in this world. You know, so fear is by not knowing your real identity. You identify with the material body, so you're fearful of losing that material body. If you think I'm servant of Krishna, you don't care if you lose the body, so there's no fear. So when it says become fearless, means you have to become surrendered to the Lord. Then the sambandha is right. That all makes sense. Right. Gain and safety. Gain is your attachment. Safety is your control. I'm in control of it, so I'm safe. So I get my gain, and then I want to make sure it's safe. So you can, that's how it'll apply here. So gain, that's why Krishna says, give up this desire for gain and safety, because that is misapplied sambandha and prayojana. The gain should be for Krishna. That safety is taking shelter of Krishna. So then you know your real shelter is Krishna. And the real gain is love for Krishna. And Krishna's satisfaction. So you have that thing. So you perform the activities, and then by consciousness you change, switch into the other. Because the activities will look the same. Or you can transcend the activities. So the detached consciousness can function in the renounced order or in the grihastha life. Doesn't matter. So it's the same principle. You can work with them or not work with them. So if it's more favorable or that, or your conditioned nature is such, or you're at that stage, then grihastha ashram would be more favorable as the way of performing naishkamya. Or if the mentality is different or for later stage in life, then naishkamya as sannyas is more favorable. So that overall principle of it doesn't matter, it still remains. It's just how the detail comes up. You know, so you have more money than the grihastha makes nicer offering to the deity, so each nicer. There's less money, he eats less. So it's still the same thing. So you're not worried about it, it's just whatever's favorable. Sannyasi, he doesn't worry about it. You go, the king feeds him nicely, the next day, you know, he gets from some poor people's house, he gets just some little chapati and some little spinach. The next day he gets nothing. So for him it doesn't matter. Same principle. Just it's applied through renunciation, while the grihastha is applied through attachment. So he's detached in dealing with attachment. And because he works in the field of attachment, but he's detached from it. The sannyasi works in the field of detachment with the mood of detachment. But because he's neutral, if into that realm of detachment comes some nice things, it doesn't matter. Because you know? That point of, you know, whether he's stones, you know, dirt clods or stones or gold, doesn't matter. It's all seem the same. So he eats nice, doesn't eat nice, doesn't matter. You know, that'll all come up. You know, this whole description of the sannyasi.
because most of it's on that. It's a big section. Mano describes a lot on there. Because the duties of the vanaprastha basically are just taking the grihastha duties, taking the essence out of them, performing in a detached way. Well, the sannyas, then it's more, it means it's already the consciousness. He changes the consciousness, but still works in the grihastha field. But here it's like he works outside of that in a more, even more detached. You know, so these principles are there for anybody. So someone who really wants to be Naishkarmiya tries to follow these principles in the mood according to their ashram. You know, like, right? Let him utter speech purified by truth. Let him keep his heart pure. Everybody tries to do that. The sannyasi, that is his occupation. The others, they try to attain that. If they don't attain it, it's not against their occupation. But for him, that's what he should focus on. Like that. So, in other words, each of the four varnas has something to offer. It means you want to study. The example of study is the brahmachari. You want to engage your senses in the Lord's service, the grihastha is the example. You want to pull your senses out of the sense objects, then the vanaprastha is the example. You want to be completely detached from the material energy, the sannyasi is. So everybody has all four in their ashram. It's just which is emphasized more. So how to take care of a guest is described in the grihastha ashram. It's not described in the vanaprastha sannyasa brahmachari, because the grihastha can be done fully. That doesn't mean that when somebody comes to the ashram of the gurukul, the brahmacharis don't take care in the same way, or the vanaprasthas or the sannyasis. But just their facilities is less, so it's not described so elaborately. It's described where it can fully be manifest. So taking care of guests is only described in the grihastha ashram, though it mentions that the others have to do it. The full detail of how to respect the teacher and study the scriptures is described in the brahmacharya ashram. The others still study the scripture and respect the gurus. But the emphasis is different. That's what makes the four varnas and ashrams. Otherwise, everybody has everything in it. Like the four yugas, all the sacrifices are in each four, but it's which one's prominent and then the other three assist.
Was it the yuga four or three?
Means each of the four yugas has all the other things of all the other yugas in it. But
like the yuga dharmas.
All four yuga dharmas are always present in every yuga, but one of them is prominent and the others are assisting. Means meditation is the main, but it's not that they don't chant mantra, and it's not that they don't do sacrifice, or in their sacrifice they're not worshipping a deity, but the meditation is the purpose. The other three help support the meditation. In the sacrifice, it's not that they don't meditate and call the deity and worship the deity and do their sacrifice or chant names, but the yajna itself is the main thing. By the yajna, then they call the deity externally. In the meditation, they call it by the mind. In the pancharatrik, then the deity is worshipped directly. They have sacrifice, they do meditation on the deity, they chant names. In Kali Yuga, then the chanting is the prominent. They still have sacrifice, they still have meditation, they still have deity worship. So in the same way as the four varnas each contain the other, and the four ashrams each contain the other. So what it means, each one is that yajna is done according to how yajnas are performed. The Vedas tell how a yajna is opened and closed. So it doesn't matter what yuga, it's always the same. So if we do yajna, we follow that. But that's not a prominent thing, chanting the holy name. Meditation, it doesn't matter which yuga it's in, it still follows the same path. It still has, you know, smriti, anusmriti, dharma, all these things. It's still there. It's just that the creator, it becomes assistant, because it's not the prominent. You can't get perfection through it, except in the yuga.
You just said that the varnas, the same principle is applied for varnas. Also, each varna contains some
element of the
elements from others.
It means everybody's serving. The Brahmin serves by his teaching, the Kshatriya serves by his protection, and Vaishya serves by his economic development.
So
The Shudra serves by just giving assistance. Everybody's creating economic development. You know, everybody's having to do some kind of organization. Everybody has to have some knowledge of study and teaching and training. Shudra is training his family members. He is training his people that are learning from him. You know, you're a carpenter, you teach the next generation carpenter. You are a teacher, but you're teaching carpentry, not Shastra. That's what makes the difference between the Shudra teaching and the Brahmin teaching. The king is also teaching his son how to be a king. You know, the Vaishya is also teaching his son business. So teaching's going on. That's when you teach the scriptures and understand the whole thing, that's Brahmin. Okay, we should probably end here.
Just one small question regarding Vanaprastha Ashram. It said also that Vanaprastha is one of their traditional duties is traveling to holy pilgrimages. So on which stage of their life starts? I mean, if they
start immediately
to live in the forest or to travel?
Both things are there. You know, it's not that they... Then when they're traveling, they're used in the forest. When they get to the holy places, those are considered like the forest. You know, the holy places, that is the forest. Yeah, it just means away from the materialistic way of life. So it's very common to go in the beginning to purify yourself. Or they may go out, perform some austerities, be comfortable with that austere life. When they're comfortable, then go out traveling, just like in the sannyas. First is Kutichak. So they live in a village on the outside of the village. I mean, they live in a hut on the outside of the village, but they're still maintained by the family. But they get used to living alone, being austere, the sadhana, eating simply. But the sun comes every day and brings food. Then when he's comfortable with that, the lifestyle, he can live there in the sadhana and all that. When that's adjusted, then he starts going out and begging from the village himself, so he doesn't take food from the house, because now he's adjusted to the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Now the economics of it, then he goes out begging. Once he's comfortable with that, then he leaves the village. Yeah? Mm-hmm. When he's comfortable with that, once he's comfortable, he begs it from every house but his own house. And when he's come to the point where he's ready to leave the village, then he goes and begs from his house. And when his wife comes to the door, he says, you know, my dear lady, give me alms. So that's when you know the guy's gone. Because then he can just go to his wife, and she's just another woman. So when she gives the alms, and that's, then they leave, then it's party with Jhakacharya. And then they go traveling. Because now they're adjusted to the lifestyle and to begging. So now they're comfortable with it, and then they can go all over the world. Then when that goes and they retire from that, then it's Paramahamsa. Then they sit down in one place and just completely focus. So that's the system.
Still, it's quite difficult to understand how it's supposed to work in modern time in our society.
You understand the principle. First, understand the principle. When the principle is understood, then you contemplate how that principle would be applied. But until if the principle is understood, then it's a matter of contemplation, seeing how it works. What is the forest? The forest means that place that is away from the whole economic development. So, whatever your situation, even if you're in the city, you take yourself out of the realm of economic development in sense gratification. So dharma is performed, but not artha and kama. And your dharma is being done for moksha. Right? Not for artha and kama. Grihastha is doing it for artha and kama. He's nice karma, he's also doing it for moksha. But when the artha and kama come, he uses it. But the Vanaprastha doesn't. Whatever he gets, he just gives it away in charity. So, the mood, if you understand, you can apply the principles anywhere. You know, like the Vedic culture is supposed to be agrarian, because everything comes from the earth. The modern, you don't connect that this thing comes from the earth. So your money economy is separated from your natural economy. Both are going on, even still today. There's people growing grains and getting gold and jewels and things of real value. But the two don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. Because the paper is just people agree to it, but it's not real. But gold has to be produced. So even if you have a gold standard, gold has to be produced. So if only how much gold you have, that's only how much money you have. But the paper, you just produce it and everybody goes hearty bowl. And, you know, then it goes up and down as people get inspired. They're inspired, the money goes up. They're not inspired, the money goes down. That's all. So the Vedic means it's connected down to the earth. So even you have coins, still they're directly connected to production. So then you don't have a problem in two different economies. You don't have the speculative economy. Because the king fixes prices and fixes duties and fixes taxes. And those are directly in connection to the value of the product. Right? That makes sense? You have a bottle of perfume. The perfume costs a certain amount, the bottle costs a certain amount. Now you put a certain percentage of the profit on that, and there you have it. You can't put on, you know, 500, 1,000% profit. You know, you can only put 20%.
Is it fixed?
Yeah, the king fixes the prices every 5 to 15 days. Depending upon the, you know, what's happening in the season and this and that, they fix the prices. And it's based on what is the value of the object and what it costs to transport. So it costs the tradesman this much, and it costs him this much transport. So above that, then he must make his profit. So that's fixed. So if it's from farther away, it costs more, then the item costs more, but he still makes the same amount of profit. But he's guaranteed his profit. But at the same time, as your people are guaranteed, they get value for money. So that way, you don't have the speculative economy. Make sense? Okay. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Is this for us?
Yeah. So it's just a reprint of the other one because I went back through and